Well, greetings and welcome to the Collector's Show for another week. I'm Harold Nickel. It's getting close to the end of July. Of course, last week we talked about collecting space memorabilia, and it's an easy transition to shift gears and talk about comics because Comic-Con is going on this week in San Diego. I didn't get to go. I would love to go. There's another one in New York in the fall, and I have hopes of going to one of them someday, but we'll just have to be satisfied with reading about it online and talking to somebody who not just goes but contributes to it. Maggie Thompson is going to be our guest in the interview segment, a real expert on comics and comic books. You'll be interested to hear from her. And of course, July also brought us the opening of another Planet of the Apes movie. And not surprisingly, there's somebody who's been collecting Planet of the Apes stuff since back in the early 1970s. This man's name is Tim Parati. He lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's 52 years old, and he has, get this, over 10,000 pieces of Planet of the Apes memorabilia. He refers to them as keepsakes, and I'll bet he stood in line to see the new Planet of the Apes movie. He started collecting his ape memorabilia back in 1973. He took his paychecks from when he was an usher at the local movie theater and bought more Planet of the Apes materials. He has survived 4 Planet of the Apes sequels, 2 television shows, comic books, and of course now the rebirth of Planet of the Apes in its latest incarnation. And he's married, and you'll hear, I think, us talk about understanding spouses during the interview segment, but he definitely has one of those. He keeps track of all of his ape collectibles with a notebook. And then he also has several sub-notebooks that catalog all of his items and how much he paid for them. So you got to figure that not just a big collection, but probably a valuable one owned by Mr. Parati. And if I can figure out how to track him down, it would be fun to have him on the show. I mentioned it was Comic-Con and lots of news for collectors coming out of that. The late Heath Ledger's iconic Oscar-winning Joker character from the 2008 movie The Dark Knight is going to be brought back to us in Lego form. The new Lego line based on Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight trilogy was introduced at the San Diego Comic-Con, and it's going to be the first time that the Heath Ledger, I guess the late Heath Ledger's take on the Joker showed up in a Lego form. The Lego minifigure portrays the Joker with that distinctive kind of weird, disturbing face makeup that was such a big part of the Heath Ledger role and take on the Joker. Of course, Hot Wheels and Star Wars have to come together. It's like chocolate and peanut butter. Hot Wheels and Star Wars. There's a Darth Vader Hot Wheels car, not just a small one, but a big one. And if you collect Star Wars or if you collect Hot Wheels, well, now you can do both, because the crown jewel for the Hot Wheels people also at Comic-Con this year is a Darth Vader tie-in die-cast car. It's the first official collaboration from Hot Wheels and the Star Wars franchise. If you picture a Corvette and Darth Vader's helmet, that's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. It's of course, it's black. It's very sleek. It's pretty cool, but the thing that's really fun is that they built a real one. It'll go 80 miles an hour and was part of the Hot Wheels booth out at Comic-Con. And an interesting tie-in, Star Wars and Hot Wheels. there were lots of other toy makers and publishers who used Comic-Con as an occasion to introduce and promote collectible toys and books out at Comic-Con. The lineup from Mattel and their rival Hasbro included a set of superhero figures that come with wearable foam Infinity Gauntlet, whatever that is, a box of Transformer figures depicting the Transformer robots as rock stars, and a giant foam replica axe from Magic the Gathering. I thought Magic the Gathering was a card game, but it may have evolved further. And since Comic-Con was this week, like I have been mentioning here during the news segment, we're going to talk specifically about comic books, because that's what Comic-Con really started out as, just about comic books. So we're going to talk about those and collecting comic books. There's a lot more to the hobby than what so many of us imagine, and especially what I imagine. I always think about caped and masked superheroes with some kind of weird, tragic backstory, but that's only part of the equation. What of librarians? A love of reading, and including girls. Do any of these have a place in the world of comic book collecting? Well, to find out, you're just going to have to stay tuned on the Collector's Show during our interview segment, which is coming up right after the music here on Web Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. It's the interview segment of the Collector's Show. This week, our guest is Maggie Thompson. Maggie is a well-known comic book collector, and I guess we generally, or at least I generally, think of comic book reading and collecting as something for the guys. It's not something that I typically think of associated with women, but I guess it just kind of shows that either I don't know anything or that I'm just a sexist pig. in any event, Maggie is going to talk with us about collecting comic books. She's a well-respected writer, author, and commentator on that topic and pop culture in general. And Maggie, welcome to the Collector's Show.
Well, thank you so much. What fun.
Well, so I mentioned the whole gender issue. Am I the only one you've met that was surprised that a woman not only collected comic books but had developed so much expertise?
I don't think people display their surprise to me because I am fairly well known at this point. Back in the day, gender wasn't that much of an issue. Understand that I'm incredibly old. So I'm 71. So when I started reading comic books, it was late 1946.
Okay.
And I learned to read with comic books. And so I was 4. And the readership at that point was roughly 50-50 as far as can be demographically determined. So that I read comic books, well, heck, so did the little girl down the block, so did my buddies, so did, and so did the guys. And so we would actually trade comics back and forth at a certain point. What happened was the evolution of the marketing of comic books has ended up with comic book purchases being made at a destination. You have to go somewhere to get the comics. And when I grew up, you just went to the newsstand on the corner, you went to the grocery store, comics were all over.
Right.
So what has happened is that the type of comic book has narrowed itself to a large extent to superhero comics. That's what you probably think of when you think of who reads comic books. You think a guy is reading Superman, Spider-Man, whatever, they're going to the X-Men movies, whatever, that it's a guy thing because it's a superhero thing because it's a let's dress up in costumes and go out and have adventures. That's not what comics were when I began to read them. That was an element, but it was not the sole element. What's happening now is that the marketing is broadening. Now, librarians are including comic books in their basic collections. And now at Comic-Con, if you walk through the lobby, it is a family event. You've got mom, dad, kids. They're all having fun. They all care about what they care about. So it is not a gender thing at all.
Well, it's interesting, you know, that you say that, you know, it was just sort of part of the scenery of where and how you grew up, and that your friends that you grew up with also read comic books, but you also mentioned the whole superhero thing. I'd like to sort of go back to what comic books were before the whole Spider-Man, Batman phenomenon sort of took over. Tell us about that.
Well, the comic books that I began collecting, I have a comic book I had when I was four. I can identify it as one I actually possess. It was Raggedy Ann and Andy.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this mix of comics that actually, as I began reading in the late 40s, pretty much that audience was still evaluated as being primarily for children. Mm-hmm. Those were not their sole readers. One of the circulation boosts that comics got was that servicemen during World War II could receive comic books and read them and toss them away. They were ideal reading on military bases and in the foxholes because you could throw them away. You could destroy them. They were Kleenex. You read that one, you threw it away. You got the next one. That was great. It means that some of those are very hard to find now, but they were universally read. But as I say, with a huge amount of the content being for little kids. So Walt Disney's comics and stories, Donald Duck comics. Oddly enough, the Archie comics, which we now think of today as kids comics and preteens and early teens comics, those actually, if you look at those early ones from the 1940s, those were almost pinup comics, very much aimed at boy readers.
Okay.
So it's like, whoa, this is what the girls are going to be like when we get to high school, is very much an element. What happened in the evolution was that more and more of these stories were aimed at older and older readers.
Mm-hmm.
So by the 1950s, and that was when I sort of hit that second, it's not that I ever stopped collecting,
mm-hmm.
but in the early 1950s, there was a comic book company called EC, Entertaining Comics, and mm-hmm. that's where Mad began. And
okay.
those were aimed at teen readers.
I was
absolutely.
I was a huge fan of Mad Magazine, by the way.
Yep. And here's a wonderful thing about the world I live in. I get to go hang out and meet the people whose work was so exciting to me as I was growing up. So I got to meet Al Feldstein. I got to meet Will Elder and the guys from Mad who
Mort
still
Drucker.
Survived. Oh, I have a little tiny Mort Drucker. He's the most fantastic caricaturist on the planet. And that's part of the fun also of collecting is you don't have to just collect the comics because there's art connected with it. You can collect the original art, hang it on your wall. So somebody who doesn't collect comics can come into your house and go, whoa, that looks familiar. So comic strips as well. That's another element of comics collecting is comic strips. So families would get the newspaper and the kids would grab the comics page. And so things like Dick Tracy, things like, I mean, name the strips, Bill Calvin and Hobbes.
When we lived in Michigan, I always wanted to do a snowman the way they had them in Calvin and Hobbes, where he would have them like they had murdered each other or had been decapitated. And the problem with the snow in Michigan, at least where we lived, was that it wouldn't pack. It was just real powdery. So I never had the opportunity to do that. But that notwithstanding, I'm still a fan of Calvin and Hobbes.
Just inspired generations. Peanuts, for heaven's sake.
Gosh, yeah.
Everybody read them. They'd stick them on the refrigerator. If it applied, they'd take it to the bulletin board, put it up at work. It's an art form. Comics are an art form. Sequential art, if you want to get all preachy about it. And I think I have not answered your question.
No, I think you did, because it has to do with the whole issue of why females got involved. And it was a lot to do, I think, with a love of art. And it sounds to me like also a love of reading.
Yes. Yep. I tell people who are very hesitant about it, you know, ooh, well, why would you have kids read comics these days? I mean, there was an era where children reading comics was highly discouraged. And I said, until very recently, one of the aspects of comics in education is no one assigns a kid a comic book to read. The reason you read a comic book is because you understand finally that reading can be for entertainment as well as information.
That's so true. And when I was a kid growing up, I wasn't as much into comics as I was into, like I said, Mad Magazine and Peanuts mm-hmm. and The Room.
Those are comics. Whoa. Those are comics.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Oh, you betcha.
Okay, not the superhero, but the room that I'm in, I have, we call it the Snoopy room because it's full mm-hmm. of Peanuts memorabilia.
Sure.
And that was something that, you know, I'm 55, but I started enjoying that when I was 9.
Well, absolutely. A, not only absolutely, but B, let's again go back to the creators. Charles Schulz was one of the most giving, loving, connected with his fans creators, so that if you were a fan and you wrote him a fan letter, you got an original strip back.
Oh, wow.
The price now, the average price now on a Peanuts original is around $10,000.
Good grief, okay? As Charlie Brown
He never sold one of them. Those were gifts.
Wow.
Those were all gifts. And what happens is the ones that don't survive increase the value of the others, but the people who have them are not going to want to get rid of them because they love them. They hang them on the wall. And he did a strip called It's Only a Game, and he would send those out too. He did not actually draw those. He collaborated on those, and he did religious panel cartoons for churches. Quite a talent, a guy. And yes, universal.
Without a doubt, and you know, it kind of gets into some of the other things I wanted us to talk about. But you said those folks would never sell any of those items. I have his autograph in one of his big, I guess it's a gift book.
Yep.
I wouldn't sell it for anything.
Yep.
And in your blog, I was reading, you had some kind of interesting things to say about owning things and having things in your collection. I guess, if you're a collector of comic books, I have it, therefore I am. is that a fair statement?
I'm not sure I'm defined by my comic books. I believe what I said was I collect it, so I have it.
Okay.
Which is a very fundamental problem if you're doing articles and writing and so forth. And but on the other hand, as you know, I think therefore I am. Yeah, mm-hmm. there's a certain amount of self-identity. Tied up in it. If you are a very lucky person, please let me emphasize luck. If you are a lucky person, you can surround yourself with things that give you pleasure.
Right.
And you need to understand not everybody is lucky. That is a very sad thing in this world today. I am an enormously lucky person. I have two great kids. I'm living. There's a writer named Harlan Ellison, whom you may have heard of. He collects more than I do, let me tell you. And his entire house is packed with things. And he calls it Ellison Wonderland. And I don't understand why he would ever want to leave his house. It is just a treasure. No matter where you look, no matter what you touch, it's got a cachet and a delight to it that is a model, I think, for collectors in general. It's just like, oh, here's this, look at this. Oh, I didn't see that. I was looking past that at this other thing. And so, as I say, but it's luck, and never figure that it isn't.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, there are people who love that stuff just as much as we, and they don't have it anymore.
Well, you're so right that if we are fortunate, we get to have things around us and people around us that we love. And
yep.
You also gave some more practical advice for preserving the things that we like and love. If you're a novice or a non-collector, what are the things that those folks should know if they decide, well, I think I'm going to start to collect comic books or any kind of printed materials? What are some good guidelines for us?
Well, the things that damage comic books are the things that damage a lot of collectors. The things that damage comic books are the things that damage a lot of collectibles, mm-hmm. specifically light, heat, and moisture.
Right.
And oxygen.
Right.
Now, the thing about comic books is that they're made with paper. The comic books back in the day are made with high sulfur paper. If it's exposed to light and heat and oxygen, it actually starts a chemical reaction in the paper that makes it burn itself, which is why you have that white paper or that cream paper that was in the comic book you bought in 1950, and you look at the comic book and you go, this is not cream paper, this is brown paper. This
right.
is actively brown. So you keep it in the dark. You keep it as cool as possible. You keep it out of water.
Yeah.
And the simplest way to accomplish a lot of that is to put it in plastic bags. So you'll see people making fun of collectors who put their comic books in plastic bags. One of the other things that destroys comic books is handling.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can handle that comic book when you're not reading it so that it doesn't get damaged simply by the fact that you have it in a pile with other comic books and the covers rub together and it makes the covers come a little loose and maybe the cat sharpens its claws on the spines of some of them, not such a good thing. So plastic bags. And the beginner, the one who just says, gee, I kind of like to collect, they can use food storage bags. I've had people say to me, food storage bags, that's terrible. Those aren't for comics. Yes, they are. They're better than nothing.
Sure.
So if somebody wants, and then again, if you get a gallon bag, you can maybe put 5 comic books in it. So you're protecting it from the light because they're all compressed in their little 5 in the bag thing. So only mm-hmm. the front and the back are going to get damaged. Don't stick them in your doggone front window so that to show everybody that you read comic books. And I'm speaking here of retailers, used bookstore display windows, that sort of thing. You walk by and you go, oh my gosh, that cover's all red. Mm. That's because it's bleached out all the other colors. So keep it out of the doggone light. But you got it in a plastic bag, then you can handle it. You can write labels all over the bag. You don't have to touch the comic book.
Sure.
And yet it lets you keep them in the order in which you would want to keep them until you can eventually, if you get enough, decide to buy the bags and Mylar.
I knew you were going to say Mylar.
The reason for Mylar bags is that it is an inert plastic. So nothing migrates in and out. It isn't going to affect the paper that it comes in contact with. Whereas if you look at an old storage comics bag from the 1970s, you'll see that they've kind of yellowed and kind of gotten a little kind of icky. On the other hand, if you have enough old comic books, you probably got some in those old bags. They hurt a lot less than just keeping the comics loose.
Well, it's a lot like preserving food, it sounds
yep.
like, air.
Yep.
And the reactions that you mentioned, and I spent most of my life in the chemical industry. Sulfur is SO2, and it reacts with single atom oxygen. And that's why it turns brown. It's oxidation.
Yep.
Same with food. And light, of course, and heat makes ink and paper, which is just pressed cellulose or trees.
Yep.
All of those things react with the atmosphere. So, yeah, I mean, I can sort of relate to whether I'm protecting my frozen squash or my comic books, the same principles apply, right?
Yes, one of the pristine collections that was practically reverently regarded by comics collectors earlier was a collection called the Mile High Collection. It was bought by a dealer in Denver, hence Mile High. But what they were in beautiful shape. They looked as if you had bought them off the newsstand, and this was a couple of decades later. Now, what was the key? They were all in boxes, closed, stored away. Mm-hmm. It handled once, put away. So even back then with no bags, dark, cool, out of the light,
right,
they kept in fine shape. And in fact, that's another scandal, was that when libraries were told in the 1960s that old newsprint was going to deteriorate terribly, and they needed to put all, the libraries needed to put all their old newspapers on microfilm and get rid of these terrible, terrible disintegrating newspapers, what has happened is the microfilm, of course, has degenerated terrifically.
Sure.
The old newspapers, which were enclosed volumes that few people ever looked at, were fine. And thank God, a man named Bill Blackbeard, if you want to talk about the king of collectors, it was Bill Blackbeard, went around to libraries and bought the bound volumes. So the libraries were delighted to get them off the shelf, on the one hand, and on the other hand, they were preserved. And those have all gone to Ohio State University and provided the most incredible archive for researchers in the probably in the world.
Well, he has a cool name, Bill Blackbeard, and
isn't it?
To remember.
Yes, he knew it. He was also an expert on pulp magazines, and he was incredibly brilliant.
Now,
but he used his house to store. If you can imagine a house full of bound newspaper volumes, there's another challenge for collectors.
Yeah, and having a spouse that's very understanding, I think, would also
Barbara
be requisite.
Barbara Tiger was her name, and yes, I think she was. I don't think she was a comics collector at all. I think she had no interest in it whatsoever.
She
was very protective of him.
Well, there you go. So let's talk a little bit about some of that history and your involvement with the Comics Buyer's Guide. I see or read that you had published it starting back in 1971, and you won all kinds of awards. Tell us about the Comic Book Buyer's Guide.
We said, well, let's do an amateur magazine about comic books and see what we can find out about it. Circulated a flyer saying we were going to do it. We did our first issue in spring of 1961. And so irregularly, we published comic art. Later, we decided that there was no newsletter to put fans in contact with each other. And so we did one of those, and we called it Newfangles, as in new fan angles. Ah, ha, 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 ha.
Oh,
okay, Newfangles.
Clever, yeah.
So it's like, who's moving? Who's got a change of address? Who had a baby? That kind of stuff. It overtook us, because that, when we were publishing regularly, we did it a monthly.
Mm-hmm.
2 o'clock one morning when we were addressing an issue, and we just said, look, this is too, we got to quit.
And the publication, I see, ceased a little over a year ago in March of 2013. I wonder if people are collecting old issues of the Comics Buyer's Guide.
Oh, yeah, they are. Yep.
I'm
told.
That's
and,
very cool.
Yeah. Well, and my trying to dig through them, sometimes somebody will say, there are a couple of instances in which Comics Buyer's Guide is the only example of a proposed comic book that was never published, because we used to do previews of stuff. So there was I think we did a Hangman preview that was supposed to come out from Archie Comics and then didn't. And a man named James Owen did a dragon thing. He's now a highly regarded fantasy writer, and he had proposed this comic book, and it never came out. So it's all kinds of fun stuff when you're doing that, and you get to know the creators, and you get to know the fans, and you get to know the collectors, and you get the challenges. The field grows and grows and grows and grows, and history doesn't go away. So you have to have all in your brain. You have to have old stuff in your brain and the new stuff in your brain, and that can be.
Now, let's talk about, I called them when I wrote up the questions comic book heroes, but I've already learned that that may be a little bit too narrow. But the superheroes, they all seem to have some kind of, you know, terrible flaw or some kind of incident that changed the direction of their lives. And I guess Batman is my favorite example, because when I read a Batman comic or I watch one of those movies, Bruce Wayne is crazy. There's no getting around it. He's out of his mind. He saw his parents murdered in front of him. Now, his, I guess, way of dealing with crazy takes on a kind of a strange direction. Are all the comic heroes, are they all manufactured, or do they all come from some tragedy turned into something positive? I think that may be the worst.
Long answer short, no.
Yeah, good.
You know, nope, that's not universal. Not only that, wasn't universal for Batman either. Glenn Weldon, who is the comic book guy on National Public Radio's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, has a book coming out next year, which is a biography of Batman, but it's decade by decade, so you can watch as each incarnation of Batman has morphed and changed and twisted and gone in different directions depending on whatever the thrust is of whoever the creators are, because that's what happens. It's the creator man story ever. The Detective Comics 27 story was actually based on a story of the Shadow.
One more word right after this. Stay tuned here on the Collector Show on Web Talk Radio. It's me, Harold Nickel. Back in a minute.
Holy clockwork, what next?
Well, next week on the Collector Show, we're going to shift gears and not talk about collectible toys or comics, but we're going to talk about radio. There was a time before television when radio was the entertainment media of choice, that are books, I guess, and movies. And the programs that were on radio led right into the development of television as we know it today. But not many people know that those programs were recorded in a style and on a media that itself is extremely collectible and in some cases very, very valuable. You will not want to miss next week's edition of the Collector's Show. In the meantime, go to the website, collectorsshow.net, to keep up with everything new in the world of collecting. Thanks again, and we'll see you here back next week on the Collector's Show.